Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome in. You are listening to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I am your host for the first hour. In the first two segments, I am spending it with a good friend, personally and of the show, Peter Buchvar. He is the chief investment advisor with Bleakley Advisory Group, also editor of the Book Report website, which I will include a link to, and a CNBC contributor. Peter, I want to start off by talking about what is on everybody's mind in terms of investment and even in terms of economic concerns. That is the Fed. We had this week a lot of Fed speakers come out. We had the Fed minutes. And more or less, there are two factions out there. One group that says, you know what, the Fed is simply paused right now, but there's still a good chance that we will see some rate hikes in 2019. And then there's this whole other group that's saying the Fed is paused, but look for them to be cutting rates, look for another QE program sooner rather than later. Please, Peter, give us some of your level-headed comments on where you think the Fed stands right now.
Well, it's this movie that we continue to see over and over again, and seemingly every cycle, is that the Fed starts to raise interest rates, and markets are fine with it because they always say, well, Fed's raising rates, but it's okay because the economy's good, and they're doing it for good reason. And then they continue to raise until they reach a pressure point. And that pressure point is created when it starts to impact growth and it starts to hurt the markets. And then everyone screams, oh, the Fed has to stop because look what they're doing to my portfolio. And I think we've certainly reached that point. So here we are with the Fed funds rate at 2.25%, 2.5%. We've just printed a December CPI number, core rate of 2.2%. So we're barely above positive on a real basis. And the Fed's balance sheet has shrunk by 10%, and everyone's screaming for it to stop. And while there are no question there's a legitimate economic slowdown going on around the world, particularly in Europe, particularly in China and other parts of Asia, that is now beginning to affect the U.S. market, the Fed is just in this unwinnable situation where they can barely get out of their policy without having an outsized impact. And it's an impossible spot they're in, but they placed themselves in the spot because they waited so long to remove this accommodation. And now they're sort of stock talking out of every side of their mouth, but also reflecting, still kowtowing to the markets. And if the stock market falls and credit markets tighten, all of a sudden they say, well, financial conditions are tightening, therefore I have to stop. But they continuously blame other reasons for that financial tightening rather than their own policy. So they continue to be in this negative feedback loop that they can't find themselves out of.
Yeah, that is very true. And you know what? I think a lot of people saw this coming in terms of market correction. But in terms of global weakness, Europe slowing down, China having issues, do you think it's fair to blame all of this simply on the Federal Reserve policy?
No, I mean, China is slowing irrespective of even the trade issues with the U.S. They're going through, obviously, a crackdown on excessive leverage and credit growth, even though they're trying to restart it in certain areas. Europe, well, their economy always is a slow grower, but particularly so now because they're very sensitive to economic activity in Asia, particularly Germany, where 40% of their economy is made up of exports, and they do a lot of business with the Chinese. Then you throw in the protests in France, which is leading to obviously a slowdown there, and then obviously Brexit, that's impacting UK business confidence and activity over there. So those are circumstances that were happening irrespective. But we know the ECB has ended the increase in their balance sheet. The Bank of Japan has cut their QE essentially in half. So you throw in these legitimate economic issues, and then with at the same time that monetary policy has been tightening, and it's a difficult situation.
Now, what about the whole concept of this balance sheet unwind? When we heard from Powell at the last press conference when the Fed hiked rates in December, he made it sound like that balance sheet unwind was on autopilot. But pretty quickly after, Powell and other Fed speakers have backtracked from that comment. Where do we stand now in your eyes?
Well, each speech seems to tell us different. Since October, Powell has gone from hawkish, and then he shifted to dovish, and then he went back to hawkish, and then dovish, and then just this past week, he talks about wanting to get the balance sheet, quote-unquote, substantially smaller. So rates are far away from neutral, and then they're just below neutral, with no rate change other than what was expected. The balance sheet is on autopilot, but then they'll be flexible, but then he wants it substantially smaller. So there's this communication breakdown because we have to understand that the Fed at this point is just winging it. People think that they are these omniscient people that just are all seeing, and they don't really know much more than we do. Granted, they have a lot of PhDs and they have a lot of business contacts, but we see what's going on as well. And this is monetary policy, play it by ear, and trying to figure it out as it goes.
Yeah, you just look at their models and their forecasts, and the Fed, even some of their comments have almost admitted that this is a whole different world, and their models and forecasts have been very off. What about some of the other central banks, the ECB or the Bank of Japan? They were all switching. It seemed like a little bit more hawkish, but they've backtracked, I think, even more than what the Fed has done in the last few months. Where do we stand globally with central banks?
Well, it's the ECB and the BOJ are 10 times worse than the Fed. I mean, Draghi and Kuroda will go down as two of the most dangerous people in the history of the financial and economic world with what they've done, all for their ridiculous goal of trying to raise the cost of living for everybody by 2% per annum. So here we have this dramatic slowing in Europe where GDP growth at best will be about 1.5% this year. And they just finished their QE program and are still reinvesting, and they still have negative interest rates, which has decimated the profitability of the European banking system. And at the same time, because they've created such a massive bond bubble, well, what's going to happen to that bond bubble when they try to get out of negative interest rates because they want to save the banks who happen to own a lot of those inflated bonds? And then you shift to the Bank of Japan, which somehow believed that buying stocks was somehow going to raise the inflation level, let alone own 40% of the JGB market, and is now realizing, well, maybe that 2% inflation target is, we should take that off the table. Well, I wish they would have thought of that 3 years ago when trillions of assets less than where they are now, and their economy is going to go into the next slowdown, and the Bank of Japan is going to be completely impotent in dealing with it. So that's going to mark really the difference between previous recessions and economic downturns from the next one because of the lack of any ability for central banks to address it. So here we have all this debt that this easy money that has created over the last 10 years. So I don't even know how they're going to be able to respond, both logistically in terms of their tools and the flow through of, okay, they're going to try to make money even cheaper in an over-indebted world. Well, there's obviously going to be no take of that. You can lead a horse to water, but they're not necessarily going to drink water. You can cut rates to zero or negative, but that doesn't mean people are going to borrow. So that's what concerns me about the next downturn, and that we're not going to get this painful but V-bottom that we've seen in the past. This is going to be more of a drawn-out, unfortunate affair.
Unfortunately, Peter, we are out of time for this first segment, but I am bringing you on next segment, and we are going to be focusing a bit more on markets and different sectors where you see some opportunity in 2019.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome back. Continuing on with Peter Buchvar. Peter, let's get into some of the market moves that we saw at the tail end of last year and now looking forward into 2019. They have been extraordinarily volatile, especially when you consider what they were like over the last couple years. But even through this 8 to 10 year bull market run, the S&P down about 20% from its peak just 3 months ago to where it bottomed just about 2.5 to 3 weeks ago. This obviously has all the central banks worried and the Fed worried and all kinds of investors worried because the game just isn't as easy anymore for those big money managers. What do you think about the overall health of the U.S. equity markets as we stand right now?
Well, it's clear that the predominant, I believe, driver of this asset price inflation we've seen has been, like I said, easy money and QE. And now that we've seen a reversal of that, markets are obviously adjusting. And the adjustment is, at least right now, mostly on the PE multiple level. You know, one of the most difficult things in investing is, yeah, it's hard enough to figure out, okay, what are earnings going to be in the next couple of years and forecasting that, but what's the right multiple to put on that earnings stream? And it's very easy to have an inflating PE or price to sales ratio or EV to EBITDA ratio when, you know, rates are at zero and you got all this liquidity out there. But when that starts to reverse, well, then how do you adjust your multiples? And so now we're getting an adjustment downward in multiples at the same time that growth is slowing and earnings are certainly going to be impacted. I mean, 40% of S&P revenues are sourced overseas. Well, if overseas growth is slowing, what do you think is going to happen to 40% of that revenue line in the U.S.? It's going to get impacted. So you have the potential, and profit margins, I believe, also have peaked. So you're going to have a moderation in earnings growth. At the same time, you're going to have a shrinkage of the P multiple, and that creates a challenging investment environment.
So, Peter, one thing we have also seen is more money moving into some safe haven assets. The U.S. dollar has been pulling back, but still remains fairly elevated or in the higher part of its trading range. But treasuries, too, have gotten a lot of a buy, and that can be surprising to some people when you consider that the Fed and other central banks have more or less stepped out of the treasury market. Do you see yields at least hitting a top last year and potentially being unable to make it back to some of those levels we saw in the later part of last year?
I think a lot will, looking out big picture the next couple of years, I think a lot will depend on what happens to these European bond yields. Do they stay at these suppressed levels? The German 10-year, which is a 22 basis points, that all of a sudden it goes to 1.5, and actually normalizes at some point because the ECB tries to get out of negative interest rates. Well, I find it hard to believe that the U.S. 10-year is going to be 2.70. I expect it to be much higher. So while right now yields are falling because there's worries about growth, certainly legitimately, and the yield curve is flattening everywhere throughout different parts of it, I think over the next couple of years, where rates go, I think, again, a lot will depend on where European bond yields go, because yields are still ridiculously low. You still have about $8 trillion of negative yielding securities. And the direction of that, again, will be the main determinant. But yeah, right now, the flattening, the declining yields, all responding to worries about global growth.
And so you mentioned this one concept a couple times throughout this call, and that is debt, both in the U.S. and globally. If interest rates move up, obviously that debt is harder to service, but at the same time, these central banks are hoping to get some sort of inflation, right around 2%, which would help to obviously service this debt. How much of a concern do you see the growing U.S. debt, especially last year, already hit $1 trillion, and that deficit seems to only be picking up steam, and this is during a so-called expansionary period?
Well, it's going to also, that all that supply is actually going to help yields stay elevated. I mean, with all the worries about growth and the worst stock market that we've seen in years in 2018, 10-year yield is still up 30 basis points from where it was beginning a year ago. So yields are still higher across the board, even with all these challenges, which tells me that there are legitimate worries about U.S. debts and deficits impacting the U.S. Treasury market in terms of all this supply. Issue and worry that I have is on the corporate balance sheet side, where corporate debt, or I should say total business debt as a percent of GDP, has never been this high outside of the first quarter of 2009 when GDP was depressed, which also leads me to believe that a lot of the big part of the 2019 story with respect to companies will be deleveraging and focusing much less on stock buybacks and capital investment.
Okay. Hey, that would be interesting to see, because still corporations have been buying back a lot of their stock. What about the precious metals too? We sometimes talk about the precious metals, but in all fairness, the last couple of years and throughout that bull market in U.S. equities, the precious metals have been under pressure. There's a lot of optimism, I know, at least from the metals community, in terms of what 2019 might bring. But one thing we need to consider is that the metals usually do get a bounce early on in the year, and then it's all about the follow through, if there is any. How do you think the setup is for the precious metals as we move into 2019?
Well, the setup is now more interesting than we've seen in years, because the Fed's probably done raising interest rates. You know, that was the bear case on the metals for the last couple of years. Is the Fed's tightening, why would you want to own it? Even though you really got to look at real rates rather than nominal rates. And real rates now are falling pretty sharply, and the dollar's down sharply here. So on this now new dovishness with the Fed, the dollar index is basically back to where it was in mid-October. And if you extend, you know, viewpoint and chart even further, you know, the dollar index is below where it was when the first Fed rate hike came in December 2015. What does that say about the dollar? Look at Europe. Look at the mess that Draghi's created with all these negative interest rates, the dramatic slowing we're seeing in the European economy, and the damage done to their banking system, and the euro is still hanging in at about 115. You know, you'd think that the euro would be much lower in the face of those facts, but it's not. And that tells me that the dollar has big picture, broader challenges that people should take note of. And I think that, again, with fundraising interest rates, even though they're still shrinking their balance sheet, well, that's going to be, in my opinion, very good for gold and silver, and pretty negative for the dollar, because the dollar's already having enough external challenges to begin with.
All right, Peter, just summarize what your themes are going to be as we are in 2019 now, what you're going to be watching most closely, and where you think investors will see at least some positive returns.
Well, we know we want to see how this trade discussion leads with China. Hopefully that will get addressed and resolved in some fashion over the next month or two before the March 1st deadline. And we know what the Fed has done and what they're likely to do from here. The question then is, put that on a micro level, and what does this all mean for corporate profits? What does this mean for the direction of that, since we know that is going to be a main driver of the stock market this year? And that's why it's fortunate that we're going to have another 6 weeks ahead of us to listen to corporate America and see what they have to say. And if the stock market reaction that we've seen so far to earnings news is any indication, it's going to be a complete minefield. All you have to do is look at what's happened to the retailers, what's happened to Delta and American Airlines, what happened to FedEx and Apple. You know, on the other hand, we're going to get some Nikes, which reported a good number. General Motors reported pre-announced a good number. So we're going to see some good and bad. But the violent reactions tell me that it's going to be a minefield. Now, investing through that, I do think that there were plenty of opportunities in overseas markets and even China. China's gotten cheap, even though I acknowledge all the short-term issues that they have. But I think there are plenty of cheap stocks in emerging markets. I've been bullish on gold and silver, as you know. And you know what? If the markets have a difficult time in the U.S., well, bear markets and declines in stock prices are actually good times to be buying stocks. I'd rather be doing that than buying them when they're in a straight line higher. So find companies you like. And because I think the market's going to present some gifts in terms of valuations.
All right. There you have it from Peter Bugvar, CIO of Bleakley Advisory Group, editor of the Book Report and CNBC contributor. Peter, it's great having you on the show. Thank you again for your time this weekend, and I hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks, Corey. You too.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition. I hope everybody enjoyed those two segments I spent with Peter Buchvar. Peter is a wealth of information and a person I get to spend a lot of time with down at that New Orleans Investment Conference. Another guest who I have a lot of respect for, who's actually still relatively new to the show, just came on as a more regular guest in about the middle of last year, is Mike Larson. You can follow Mike on Twitter at his handle, at Real Mike Larson. I will post that within this weekend show posting. He also writes the Safe Money Report over at Weiss Ratings. And Mike, one thing that we have to talk about here is the U.S. equity markets, and the overall concept that I have heard from a number of people is that this recent rally in the markets could very much be over. This, if you look at the chart, just speaks to more bear market behavior because of the fact of this downtrend and this downward channel that the markets remain in. Can you address this first?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we've been talking for a while, and I've kind of been on the cautious bearish slash bearish side of the fence since, let's call it March or April of last year, 2018. And, you know, everything I've seen sort of from a technical standpoint and fundamental standpoint has continued to kind of reinforce that thesis as opposed to refute it. And, you know, it's interesting that you talk about what's happened the last few weeks. I mean, obviously, the markets fell very sharply in December. You had the worst month for the Dow and the S&P 500 since 1931. Full year 2018 was the worst for the S&P since 2008 in terms of percentage declines. Obviously, that was, you know, there's a lot more turmoil than now, but in terms of the final, you know, year-end result. But then starting the day after Christmas and continuing through, you know, through early January, we saw pretty sharp rallies, like 2,200 points on the Dow off the lows. What's interesting is you get these moves, and these are the kinds of things that are extremely sharp, extremely short-term, and over time are extremely vulnerable to being retraced. And that's part and parcel of bear markets. I mean, I've been following the markets closely since the mid-1990s. And it's interesting that I see a lot of similarities to what's happening for the last several months to what happened at the start of the bear markets in 2000 to 2002, and again in 2007 to 2009. You know, you look at, again, sharp declines followed by sharp snapback rallies that don't get you back to the highs, that do start to, you know, make people think, hey, maybe the worst is over. That's typical bear market behavior. It's funny, there's somebody else I follow on Twitter, at Odd Stats, which always has, as the name suggests, has a lot of odd financial stats and market stats as well. And they did a great breakdown that looked at every single time the S&P 500, going back to the 1920s, had a 20% decline and then had a bear market rally, and sort of said, okay, how long do those bounces last? How many days? How far did they go? And then what ultimately happened after that sort of ran out of gas? And the funny thing is, out of all 12 of these instances, you know, the sharpness of those rallies was pretty significant, anywhere from 3%, 4%, 5% on up to 15, you know, or 14% or 15%. But what happened in almost every instance, besides one or two, is that, you know, within, let's call it a week, a few weeks, as long as maybe a month and a half, the markets were rolling over again, and after they did that, the ultimate declines from high to low got pretty severe. I mean, you had, you know, in the bear market of 2000 to 2002, the S&P 500 lost 50% from high to low. In the bear market of, you know, 07 to 09, the S&P lost 57%. Other bear markets that you know, came earlier in the 80s and 70s and so on, and the ultimate declines weren't that bad, but you're still talking about 30, 40, you know, almost 50% losses in some case. So, again, history kind of tells you, and if you've been in the market, sort of intuition should kind of tell you that what's happened here, it doesn't really change the big picture. It gives you, you know, a nice opportunity that if you're still holding a lot of longs, if you didn't get out when I was, you know, when me and other analysts were maybe saying, hey, this bull market's over many, many months ago, now you got another chance. You get out at better prices, you lower your equity exposure, or if you're more aggressive and you're comfortable with those kinds of investments, you can look into things like inverse ETFs or put options or LEAPS put options that make money when stocks, targeted stocks or sectors or indexes go down. I think that that's how you have to sort of flip the mentality. You know, in the bull market, whenever markets fell, you bought the dip and they ultimately headed higher. now in a bear market environment, you got to kind of, you know, change your thinking and say, you get a rally, you're not, or, you know, when the market sells off, you want to take profits on short positions to sort of get out of the way, wait for the market to rally, and then that's when you reinitiate them. It's sort of like selling the rally versus buying the dips.
Yeah, that's something that you and I chatted about, I think, a couple months ago as well, is how that mentality had changed and how investors need to get on board with that. Can we talk about, though, that strategy that you were talking about? If you are holding some long positions, not the worst time to probably clear out of some of those positions after these rallies. But in terms of those investors that maybe don't want to play the short side, whether it's because they don't believe in playing the short side or, you know what, they got burned the last 4, 5, 8 years for that matter trying to play the short side. There are other sectors where they can put some money to work and you think could actually present some good returns?
You know, I think there's two ways to look at it. And I guess it depends on how aggressive or how, you know, whether you're a trader or an investor. If you're an investor who's looking at your intermediate to long-term time frames and holdings, I think there's still a handful, you know, a small number of stocks in conservative sectors, the same types of sectors I've been talking about for, you know, a year now. Things like utilities, things like consumer staples, high dividend yielding, lower volatility, higher Weiss rated stocks that are in conservative sectors that still have some potential. That's, I think, you know, for your, the stuff for your longer term money, these are the kinds of stocks that are likely to lose less in down moves in this bear market and gain more in up moves. And in some cases, hopefully, I think if you find the right stock, you're going to generate absolute returns. So it's not just lose less money, it's actually make money, especially from the dividend yield side of things. So there's a few names like a Clorox, for example, or a One Gas, you know, CLX and OGS. Those are two stocks that we've owned in the Safe Money Report for some time now that are holding up better, that are delivering some yield, giving you more stability and so on, and things that I still like. On the other side, if you look at what is going to get, in my opinion, destroyed in this bear market, it's going to be the same kind of stuff that got radically overvalued. I mean, you look at some of these semiconductor names, some of these, you know, red hot, so to speak, tech names, some of them are down 40, 50% from their highs, but I don't think that's over, especially for some of the names that haven't gone down that much. At the same time, when you get these deeply oversold markets and then you have sharp rallies like we just had, those are the kind of names that until people get it, you know, beat into their heads that this is a stupid way to invest, those are the kinds of names that are going to have very sharp rallies. I mean, Netflix, I think, recently was up like 25, 30% in a week and a half or 2 weeks during this bear market rally. So if you're a trader, if you're an aggressive trader, you wait for the market to get deeply oversold, you buy some of these stocks that ultimately are headed a lot lower, but that can, in the short term, generate some very big gains. Again, it comes down to what kind of investor you are. If you want to trade this market, buy the junkier stuff when the market's deeply oversold and flip it. If you're an investor who's looking for patient, longer-term, sensible-type investments that I think hold up, that's where you go to your consumer staples, your utilities, and the other defensive-type names.
So regarding some of these defensive names, what about some of these so-called safe haven bets, as in precious metals or treasuries or even emerging markets if we do start to see the U.S. dollar fall?
Sure. Again, I think that, you know, it's hard to recommend very long-term bonds. You know, our country, I think, has plenty of debt and deficit issues. But I mean, you know, that's from an investment standpoint. From a short to intermediate term, I think the bond market is going to rally when the stock market goes down. From a tactical standpoint, I've had a couple of recommendations in our service that actually make money from rising bond prices, and that's gone okay for us. In terms of gold, you and I have talked about this before. I'm not a gold bug by nature, but I certainly have really liked it at times, really hated it at times, and sometimes been indifferent. I'd put it in the really like it category now, and I have for, you know, the last few months. I think technically the picture has been improving. I think gold and volatility have a lot in common. They're both, you know, sort of buying volatility, buying gold as a chaos insurance play. I think that's one of the reasons the metal's been firming up recently, even when the dollar was on its way higher, the U.S. dollar was on its way up. And I don't think that sort of dynamic is going to change. I think gold and gold miners in an environment of rising volatility, rising risk, you know, a need for insurance on the, you know, among investors, I think those are the kinds of environments that are going to be pretty positive for gold. So I still like the metal here.
All right, Mike, always great having you on the show. Again, follow Mike on Twitter at RealMikeLarson. It's important to understand what somebody like Mike is looking at in terms of investments. He was never truly sucked into some of these high-flying stocks, and we were talking months ago about the weakness in terms of the markets, both internally and on price stability. And what we have seen is a very much start of what looks like it could be a bear market, But remember those time frames. It can take a couple years for these bear markets to play out. So as much as some people might want it to happen quickly, it is an overall process. Mike, great chatting with you. Everybody stick around. I'm going to be right back to wrap up the show with Jeffrey Christian.
Thank you. Take care.
Welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I am chatting with Jeffrey Christian. He is the managing partner over at CPM Group. And Jeff, we will talk about the metal sector and different aspects within the metal sector. But first, I just want to get your initial comment on the overall health of the U.S. economy and the U.S. markets, simply because there's so many differing opinions out there. There are some people who are uber bearish and some people who still think that, you know what, there could be some decent growth for U.S. economies and the U.S. market still might be moving higher. This all relates to Fed policy as well. I just have to ask you, where do you stand? Are you bullish, bearish, neutral on the U.S. economy and the U.S. markets throughout 2019?
We're pretty much right in the middle. I wouldn't say we're neutral. I mean, we're looking for a relatively strong growth in the U.S. economy overall. Not as strong as last year, but still relatively healthy. We're not necessarily looking for a recession in the United States. You know, we are in the late stages of an economic expansion. That's quite clear from some of the factors like productivity and wage gains and housing and auto sales. But we're not sure that we roll over into a recession this year or next year. Politics obviously have a lot to do with that. So we think that the uber bears are overly bearish and the uber bulls are overly bullish. I think there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty on the part of the financial markets right now. So you'll have an individual investment bank where one part of the bank is saying that they're looking for strong growth and a positive stock market. And another part of the same bank might be talking about, you know, another 30% down on the Dow over the course of 2019. I think there's that uncertainty is going to be in there, and that's going to feed into our expectations on precious metals. But I think it's also going to serve as something of a break on consumer demand and business investment in 2019, which will keep that growth going, but not running very strongly and not running as strongly as it was in 2018.
Okay, so just as you said, this uncertainty should help out the precious metals, and it already has been helping out the precious metals. Just look at the bottom and the base that was put in that really ended in October when gold and silver started moving higher. In terms of gold, though, right now, is it mostly just a fear trade in your eyes? People just being uncertain, trying to protect some of their capital?
I wouldn't necessarily say fear trade, but it's definitely portfolio diversification. You are seeing a number of participants who are looking at gold and silver as capital appreciation plays. So you're seeing people who say, you know, these things have been hammered down over the course of the second half of 2018. The stock market has been hammered down somewhat, but it's still relatively high. The bond market is still relatively high. Bonds and stocks are still vulnerable to the downside. Gold and silver seem to be more likely to rise from current levels than they are to fall. Some value investors on a shorter term basis in the markets, but we're also seeing a lot of other people who are saying, as I said earlier, yes, you know, regardless of what you think about today or tomorrow or the next 2 months or 3 months, we're probably moving into the late stages of an economic expansion, and that's bad for the stock market, and it's probably going to be good for gold and probably also for silver.
Now, regarding silver, some of the bulls for the precious metals have been saying, look, silver is finally starting to outperform gold, lead to the upside. What do you have to say to those comments?
You know, I'm very cautious. We think that the silver price could rise 12 or 13% this year on an annual average basis, which would put it around $18 or $19 by the end of the year. But that's $18 or $19. You know, you're not talking about $30, $40, $50 the way some of these guys are. But you have to take that 13% increase in context. Gold prices rose about 0.2% last year on an annual average basis. We expect them to rise about 0.2%, or about 2% this year. So you're seeing gold prices, we're expecting gold prices to rise at a modest pace on an annual average basis. But with silver, okay, it's plus 13%, it's a much greater increase than in gold, but that's because silver was off 9% last year. So silver is sort of playing catch up with gold because silver was hit much harder in the second half of 2018 than gold was. So yeah, we're bullish, and yes, we think that the price is headed in the right direction, and investors are starting to come back onto the long side of the silver market, and you're seeing, you know, continued strong demand for silver and electronics and solar panels and a couple other applications. But the reality is that silver's playing catch up with gold because it got hammered so hard in the second half of last year.
So Jeff, because CPM works with so many different type of clients providing advice on the resource market, I always find it interesting to hear from you if you think that new money is actually starting to come into this sector, or if it's just money that has been sitting on the sidelines looking at this market. Essentially, are the precious metals drawing new investors in right now, or is it the same breed that's just putting their money back in?
It's sort of the same breed. We did see a wave of new investors really in 2016, 2017, into early 2018. People who probably were not involved in gold and silver futures or ETF basis or even the mining shares in the past. But I think that a lot of those people have backed away due to the weakness that we saw in the second half of last year. And right now, I think what you're seeing is people who have been in the precious metals on a cyclical basis coming back in on the long side, having either gotten off to the sidelines or actually gone short last year.
So, Jeff, when it comes to maybe some of the stocks or some of the companies underlying these precious metals, do you see a sweet spot there? Do you see an area or an environment where certain sectors within the precious metals could outperform this year if we do see just a general increase in precious metals prices?
In terms of the stocks, you know, I think that you might want to look at late stage exploration and pre-development type companies, and also mid-tier producers, because I do think that the mergers and acquisitions and takeover aspect of the precious metals will probably continue as you have some of these larger guys looking to buy growth because they can't find it organically in their own exploration programs. So, but you know, we tend to look more at the commodities than at the equities. But that said, you know, the equities have been doing, gold equities have been doing somewhat better than gold. But again, it's like silver. They were hammered down so severely in 2018 that you're finding some bottom feeders picking up stocks now.
Now, what about the base metals? Let's quickly touch on those, because base metals have really been depressed, and a lot of that has been, or at least the argument has been, due to trade wars, and I think more significantly, just slowing global growth. Europe continues to be weak, China continues to be weak. What are the major factors in your eyes that are at play for these lower base metals prices?
Well, I think that what you're seeing in the base metals is a variety of factors, one of which is, expectations of slower economic growth. And I think that will probably keep aluminum and copper and some of the other base metals sort of in a narrow, low trading range over the course of the year. There are some fundamentals there. There are stock builds in some of the markets. We're actually a little bit more bullish on lead than we are on the others. And again, I think that reflects expectations that you're going to see some demand for lead in replacement batteries over the course of the winter. There's a seasonality there that we think will probably kick in and help support lead at this time.
Are you guys playing a lot or paying a lot of attention to these battery metals? They've really come on trend. A couple years ago, a bit of the bullishness seemed to dissipate. Do you see that carrying over at all?
Well, we've been on record as being relatively cautious on cobalt, if not outright bearish. And you know, we're not so bearish on lithium as we are on bearish on new lithium exploration, development, and production. You know, our view is that the expectations of the introduction of electric vehicles in the metals markets far exceeds the expectations in either the auto industry or the electricity production and distribution industry. And you talk to the auto industry and the electric industry, they do see electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles coming along, but at a much slower pace than, say, the lithium exploration people and some of the stock analysts on Bay Street in Toronto seem to expect. So we're being more cautious. You are seeing substitution away from cobalt. So we've been more bullish on manganese than we have been on cobalt. We've been warning people not to invest in like lithium mining properties outside of Chile and Argentina, and not to invest in cobalt properties except things that are in production at low cost right now, because you know our expectation was, and we're starting to see it, engineering cobalt being engineered out of batteries. And part of what's happening is you're moving out of cobalt into nickel and manganese. And the electric vehicle market is a very big component of cobalt demand, but it's a relatively small part of the nickel and manganese markets. So you're not necessarily going to see tremendous demand price increases in core manganese and core nickel, but you will see very strong demand and price strength in nickel sulfate and manganese sulfate, because that's what's actually used in the batteries, and that's where you have the capacity constraints. So, yeah, we've been more cautious on electric vehicles than a lot of other people, simply because there's not enough electricity around to see as rapid a transition to electric vehicles as some people seem to think that there will be.
All right, there you have it from Jeffrey Christian. Jeff, it's always great having you on the show. I really appreciate what CPM Group does in terms of, I believe, taking a very level-headed look at a wide range of commodities in the resource sector. Everybody, I hope you enjoyed the first hour of the weekend edition. Please keep in touch, Fleck@kereport.com. After last week's show, I got a number of emails on different companies. People wanted my advice or my insights, as well as some of our guest insights. Please keep those emails coming, and I am more than happy to take a look at any companies and get some of our guests to take a look at those companies as well. Jeff, have a great rest of your weekend. Thanks again for your time.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.